I've titled my first message for this new year, "Here's Something Worth Remembering." Normally, I would begin a message with a story or an illustration designed to sort of whet your appetite for what's coming and cause you to wonder what it is that we should remember if it's so important to be speaking on it on the very first Sunday of the year. What is that something? Well, I've decided to just cut to the chase and not go into a story or give an illustration, but simply tell you what it is. You are not in charge. Five words that some of you still don't believe. So let's make it personal. I am not in charge. To help that to happen, say it with me. Here we go. I am not in charge. Now say it like you mean it. Here we go. I am not in charge. Stop. There are two realms where we love to be in charge. We love to be in charge of others. Why in the world do they do that? How could they get away with that? Or what's wrong with her? We love being in charge of others. And I might as well say it, we love being in charge of ourselves. After all, we're adults. We've paid the price of reaching this age. As Abraham Lincoln put it, any man beyond the age of 40 is responsible for his own face. I like that. You're responsible for your own life, but wait a minute. Did you direct the affairs of your life over those past years? The last time I checked, you didn't really have a whole lot to do with it. You were the recipient of one who chose to direct your life. Whether you cooperated or not is another story. But the fact is, I am not in charge of anyone else. I am not even in charge of myself. Unless you misunderstand what I'm saying in that second part, is that I don't open my own doors or close them. I don't manipulate situations so that I'm able to do whatever I plan to do. I'm not speaking against wise planning. I am really talking about mistaken kind of thinking that I set my life in concrete and that's the direction I will take. And I'm going there, thank you, whether you like it or not, including God. So let's just put it right down and break it into the categories. You are not in charge of others. You are not in charge of yourself. That is what James chapter 4, verses 11 through 17 teach us. James is not a dreamer. He's a very practical mind. So he speaks bluntly, and I will do the same. James isn't worried about whether you like him or not. He isn't worried about whether you feel good after you read what he writes. I feel the same after telling you what I say. My responsibility is not to make you feel good. My responsibility is to tell you the truth. In many ways, I'm like a physician. If I were your physician and you came to me and you had a tumor, it would make you feel better if I didn't tell you about it. But that's called malpractice. I need to tell you the truth, whether you like to hear it or not. Because only on the basis of the truth can you deal with reality. So that's where we're going in these few minutes we're together, learning about this something that's worth remembering. I hope you will say to yourself each week through the next number of weeks this year, I am not in charge. Just five words. Easy to remember. Hard to practice. To begin with, I'm not in charge of others. Verses 11 through 12 talk about that. When I try to take charge of others, what do? Well, I speak against them and I judge them. James addresses both. Look at it, verse 11. Don't do that. Stop doing that. Since you are not in charge of anyone else, do not speak evil against or criticize dear brothers and sisters. See the word speak against right here in the verse. Kata laleo is the Greek combination of two words. Kata means down. Laleo means to talk. Like yada, 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 to speak. And when you put them together, it means to talk down, speak against, put down. Don't do that. Don't do that. You're not in charge of anyone else. You see, when you do that, you not only ignore your own faults and failures, you do that behind the person's back. And that's a cowardly thing to do. If it's so bad, and if something needs to be confronted, and it's for the good of the other individual, wait until you're alone, and at the right time and in the right tone, confront the person to his or her face. That's not putting them down. That's being faithful as a friend with a friend. Proverbs 27:6, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. It doesn't help me when my enemy kisses me. It does help me when my friends wound me. The Hebrew is quite colorful. Faithful are the bruises caused by the one who loves you. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. When I was at seminary, I was an upperclassman about to finish that senior year, and had been in chapel where a missionary had spoken and had not done a really great job. And I took it upon myself to criticize the man who spoke in chapel. And I was with a couple of my buddies who listened, and I was overheard by an underclassman who happened to be on the missions committee of the seminary and knew the whole story. And he came up to me and he said, "Chuck, why would you say that? Do you know what that man's been going through?" And I didn't. By the way, that's also a reason not to criticize, because you don't know all the facts, like I didn't. Said, "Do you know that the man's wife died 3 months ago?" I didn't. "Did you know that just this morning he received a phone call and his son was in a terrible auto accident? He doesn't yet know the full condition. But still, he was willing to come and to speak. Did you know that happened?" I will never forget the reproof, even though it happened 1962. The fall of 62, he confronted me with my loose tongue. Oh, that everyone would be that good a friend. When you hear something like that said about some other person that's negative, ask the individual, do you know all the facts? Why are you saying that about, what about your life? You see, right away we become convicted because we are far from perfect, which takes us to the word judge. That means to bring condemnation on another, and only one is qualified for that. Who are you to condemn another? You don't control destiny. And if you wonder about judging, check out Matthew chapter 7. Remember the log in your own eye as you look for the speck in your brother's eye? Don't go there. William Barclay has written, there are a few sins which the Bible so unsparingly condemns as the sin of irresponsible and malicious gossip, and to listen to a slanderous story. And yet, it is for most a fascinating activity. The small group that you run with, are you critical in that group? Have you reached such a low level that it's now about other people? Is that healthy? It certainly isn't right. I've spoken with coaches who tell me one of the best things they can do is coach a team up. I coached them up, which means I helped the player know how to be better at that position. I helped him or her understand how to run that play or how to handle that particular moment. How to dribble the ball, how to take care of these very difficult parts of the game. I coached him up. That's his desire here. If you criticize and judge each other, you're criticizing and judging God's law. That's not your call. You see, we step into a role that only God is qualified to fill. Only He knows everything. Only He knows all the facts. Second, as I said earlier, we ignore our own faults and failures. And third, I will add, we assault our love relationship when we do that. I know this when I really pray faithfully for another, I cannot say things ugly about them. So I know when I say things ugly or someone else says something ugly, I know prayer isn't going on. Remember love, L-O-V-E, when you love someone, L, you listen to them. O, you overlook faults. V, you value what they have to say and their presence. E, you express your gratitude, your affection. You encourage them. But when you put them down, you do none of the above. So, for this year, let's you and me agree, since you and I are not in charge of others, let's agree that we will not operate as though we are, and we'll stop putting people down and judging them. We would be miles ahead in relationships if we would just cover those two bases. How wonderful it would be to have that kind of verbal integrity. That's first. Now, the second reminder, we're not even in charge of ourselves, verses 13 to 16. Look here, James begins this 13th verse, and in this 13th verse, he puts his finger on five things an individual does who attempts to control his own life or her own life. Number one, look at how he puts it. You who say today or tomorrow. So we begin by setting our own hard and fast schedule. Now, wait a minute. There's going to be someone hearing this that's going to say, well, you mean we're not supposed to plan? We're not supposed to organize our life? That's not what he's dealing with. So let me clarify that. There's a proverb that says, a man's heart devises his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Is everything right about devising your way? Every New Year's Day, you wouldn't know this if I didn't tell you, so I'll let you in on a little activity I do virtually every New Year. I say virtually because some things have come up and I haven't been able to. But I take my day timer, small book I carry, which is the calendar of every day in the year, January through December, with all the pages in between, double page for the calendar, and I go to the calendar of each month, and I enter into that calendar the events of that year, all the birthdays of those I love and want to remember, all of the significant events that have been planned, those trips I'm to take, speaking responsibilities, and on it goes. Takes me about 5 to 6 hours to complete my day timer. I go through it meticulously. All the while, if not saying it aloud, thinking, Lord, at any time, I'm at your disposal. You want to bring any change to any part of this? Please do. I invite you to do that. Nothing here is in concrete. This is as best I can plan my life because I have a number of responsibilities I juggle in my roles as an individual. And I need to keep some of them separate. I need to make sure there aren't conflicts, that I don't plan an event on top of another one or too close to another one. I need to organize my life. He's not addressing that wise kind of devising of one's way. He's talking about an individual who declares or sets in concrete, hard and fast, this will be my schedule, today or tomorrow. Remember that word tomorrow. I'll get back to it. Look further in verse 13. We are going to a certain town. So the second an individual does when he thinks he controls his or her own life, we declare our own destination. That is where we will be. That is where we will move. That is where we are going. We are going to a certain town. Notice how it's written. And we'll stay there a year. Third, we determine our own limits. Going to be there a year. That's the plan. That's what I want. That's what I plan. That's what I'm going to do. We will stay there a year. Fourth, we arrange our own agenda. We will do business there. That's the plan. My plan. I'm going to do that. We will do business there. And notice he wraps it up with, and we'll make a profit. We predict our own outcome. When we're in charge, that's what we're going to do. That's going to be the result. Observe what's preeminent in verse 13. I, my, me. I mean, after all, remember the song? I like that song. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, so why can't I? Well, part of the reason is you're not a bluebird. So you're not going to be flying over some rainbow. That's written by some dreamer who thought of it while he was sitting on a hilltop somewhere, strumming a guitar in torn jeans and barefoot, thinking up a song. Okay? That's not James. James doesn't do that. Here's another one. I did it my way. You heard that one? Old Blue Eyes. I did it my way. And you're proud of that? Is that what you want? You want your way? How many people planned a profit and didn't make a profit? Don't answer out loud. How many planned to do business and it never really materialized? How many planned that year, but it wasn't a year? Change, because you're not in charge. See, this is mistaken confidence. It's presumption. Because I am not in charge, I have no right to do those things. In fact, he really does dig in verse 14. Look at the question. How do you know what your life will be like tomorrow? Your Bible probably reads, you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You don't. How are you going to feel tomorrow? You don't know. What will happen as you're driving tomorrow? You don't know. What will that phone call be that comes in the middle of the night tonight? You don't know. What will be the outcome of that surgery that's planned for tomorrow? You don't know. When it comes to tomorrow, three words fit. I don't know. That's why I am not in charge. Only one knows. Only one. That's why he's in charge. When will we learn this? I hope in this new year we learn it early. Lord, you're in charge. This is your day. It's on loan to me. Thank you for allowing me to live it, but it's yours. It's got your name written all over it. I want it to be for your glory. I don't want to be involved in anything that you don't want. So stop me. Turn me. Reverse my plan. See, because we're mere humans, we have no idea what the future includes. A rude intrusion changes everything. That's why one of the most uneasy words in our language for us to deal with is unexpected. Tomorrow has that word written all over it. How could you know what to expect until you have lived it? Unexpected diseases. Unexpected accident. Unexpected delays. Unexpected financial reversal. Unexpected stroke. Unexpected phone call. Unexpected email. Unexpected letter in the mail. Unexpected stroke. Unexpected shooting. Unexpected tornado. Unexpected fire. Unexpected response. If I may, to go where James is going, unexpected death. Death. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. Your life, now he gives a good analogy. Look closely. Your life is like the morning fog, like a mist, says one of the renderings. Another renders it, a puff of smoke. Here's eternity forever and ever with a limitless, and there's no ending. That's life on this earth. Believe me. Hear me. More importantly, hear this. Your life is like the morning fog here a little while, then it's gone. The beautiful part about all of this is with the one who's in charge, there are no surprises. There are no surprises. My mother and dad had two children, a boy, a girl, and they thought that was it. Alpha, Omega. Two kids. Perfect. Hi. Out of the blue, they found out. Well, you know what? Earl, my mother must have said to my daddy, Earl. Number three is coming. I understand from my folks a cute story. I never met my paternal grandparents. My dad's father died while he was in high school, and he had to quit school so she wouldn't starve. And he went to work to help his mother have something to eat and to help the family survive. But his mother lived on through the births of my dad's three kids. And they were visiting my paternal grandmother, who I understand was really a hot dog. Probably not a good word to use, but she's gone now, so she won't slap me. But she stood about 4'7", a little southern rebel, and my daddy used to tell stories on her. And so they were there visiting, and their little boy, Orville, my brother, was just out of diapers. Lucy was still in diapers, and I was in the oven, about ready to make my entrance. And my mother was kind of waddling through the house, and my grandmother, I understand, looked at my mother and said to my dad, Earl, come here to me. So he's 6'1". She's 4'7". She goes, Earl, listen to me. He goes, yes, ma'am. The Bible says to be fruitful and multiply and to fill the earth, but he never expected one woman to do it all. Leave her alone. I guess he did. I was the last child. And I understand he said, yes, ma'am. I was not a surprise to God. I was certainly a surprise to them. Maybe you were a surprise. I've never let that bother me. I was born, I was never abused or mistreated. I wasn't wanted, but here I was. And I was told early that I was a mistake. And I thought, hey, I like that. You know, I'm going to show them who I really am. And so I got a lot of whippings and had to learn how to live life correctly, still working on it. But my dad knew our family would have three kids. My God knew that. My dad thought they would have the two. My mother figured they'd have maybe one. And here she was with three kids. She didn't do really well with little kids. Hi. Here I am. Now I'm having a little fun with this, but that's the way it unfolds. If the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or that. Some babies don't live. Some children don't live. Some die what we call prematurely. There is no such thing. With God, nothing is premature. His plan is perfect. But because we like to control our lives, we put a timetable on things, and we're born, so we'll live a long life. You have no hope of that. You don't know if you'll be here this time next year. I don't know that either. We hope to be, we want to be, but we don't know. God knows, because he's in charge. Now, I think you've gotten the point very clearly, and I'm overworking it, because it's a tough one to believe and obey. Because when this meeting is over, and we've all gone to our places of residence, maybe even on our way home, we quickly tend to forget. And before we know it, we're bad-mouthing someone, or we're planning our own way and putting it in concrete, and we're disappointed because it didn't happen. Nobody gave you the right to call your own shots. You see, we live in such a me-ism day that when we don't get our way, there's something wrong with it, or with you for telling me I don't have a right to do that or think like that. Now, I'm not telling you. I'm just reading you what James says. You ought to say, if the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or that. What else does that mean? If the Lord wants us to. I plan to attend a funeral tomorrow. I hope I'm able to be there. I certainly hope to bring encouragement and comfort to some who grieve. I hope we make it to the funeral and get back, and we've had a chance to be with those we love. But that's my plan, and I hold it loosely because it's not my life. I hope to be here next Sunday preaching out of Romans chapter 6 as we get into a 6, 7, and 8 segment of Romans together. I hope that will unfold. I'm planning on it, but it's all written in pencil with a big eraser. That's how we live our lives. All for his glory. All for his pleasure. Otherwise, he says, if you don't live like that, verse 16, you're boasting about your own plans, and all such boasting is evil. Look at that. You're boasting about your own plan. That's evil. So that's a sin. Don't do that. Don't do that ever through this new year. And then at the end of the passage is a stinger. When you play in a band and you play marches, that march usually will end with one note. Boop! It's called a stinger. Just one quick staccato, boop, and the band, boop, hits it, and the march is over. This is a stinger in this passage. It begins with, remember, remember, remember what? Look, it is sin to know what you ought to do and then not do it. I am not going to touch that except to say it means exactly what it says. You have heard what we need to do. A whole year of not putting people down, a whole year of giving God the credit, the glory, and full reign of our lives, a whole year of pleasing him, not ourselves. I know that, but when I come to that date in my day timer that I've marked with my ballpoint pen, and I realize that's not going to happen, I don't grieve that. I say, Lord, you have your way here. I'll X that day out from my plan because you've got your right to do what you wish. Horatio Bonar put it this way, "Thy will, not mine, O Lord, however dark it be, lead me by thine own hand, choose out the path for me. I dare not choose my lot, I would not if I might. Choose thou for me, my God, so shall I walk aright. Choose thou for me, my friends, my sickness, or my health. Choose thou my cares for me, my poverty, or my wealth. Not mine the choice in things both great or small. Be thou my Lord, my love, my wisdom, and my all." I saved a story for the end of this message that I didn't have time to give in the first service, but I want to read the story to you. It illustrates the value of speaking well of one another, doing what is right. Just sit there and listen. Don't look at your watch one time, okay? Don't rattle your keys. It won't change my plan to reading the story. I'd love to be home watching the pro ball game right now, but I want you to hear this story. It's that valuable. He was in the third grade class I taught at St. Mary's School in Morris, Minnesota. All 34 of my students were dear to me, but Mark Eklund was one in a million, very neat in appearance. He had that happy-to-be-alive attitude that made even his occasional mischievousness delightful. Mark also talked incessantly. I tried to remind him again and again that talking without permission was not acceptable. What impressed me so much, though, was the sincere response every time I had to correct him for misbehaving. "Thank you for correcting me, sister," he would say. I didn't know what to make of it at first, but before long I became accustomed to hearing those words many times a day. "Thank you for correcting me, sister." One morning, my patience was growing thin when Mark talked once too often. I made a novice teacher's mistake. I looked at Mark and said, "If you say one more word, I'm going to tape your mouth shut." It wasn't 10 seconds later when Chuck blurted out, "Mark is talking again." I hadn't asked any of the students to help me watch Mark, but here it is. We take charge of others' lives. You see it? But Chuck had said that, and since I had stated the punishment in front of the class, I had to act on it. I remember the scene as if it had occurred this morning. I walked to my desk very deliberately, opened the drawer, and took out a roll of masking tape. Without saying a word, I proceeded to Mark's desk, tore off two pieces of tape, and made a big X with them over his mouth. I then returned to the front room, to the front of the room. As I glanced at Mark to see how he was doing, he winked at me. That did it. I started laughing. The entire class cheered as I walked back to Mark's desk and removed the tape and shrugged my shoulders. His first words were, "Thank you for correcting me, teacher." Sweet story. At the end of the year, I was asked to teach junior high math. The years flew by, and before I knew it, Mark was in my classroom again. He was now more handsome than ever and just as polite. Since he had to listen carefully to my instruction in the new math, he did not talk as much in ninth grade. One Friday, things just didn't feel right. We had worked hard on a new concept all week, and I sensed the students were growing frustrated with them, with themselves as well, and edgy with one another. I had to stop this crankiness before it got out of hand, so I asked them to list the names of the other students in the room on two sheets of paper, leaving a space between each name. Then I told them to think of the nicest thing they could say about each of their classmates and write it down. It took the remainder of the class period to finish the assignment, but as the students left the room, each one handed me their paper. Chuck smiled. Mark said to me, "Thank you for teaching me, sister. Have a good weekend." That Saturday, I wrote down the name of each student on a separate sheet of paper, and I listed what everyone had said about that individual. On the following Monday, I gave each student his or her list. Some of them ran two pages. Before long, the entire class was smiling. I overheard, "Really?" as one whispered, I never knew that meant anything to anyone. Another, I didn't know others liked me so much. No one ever mentioned those papers in class again. I never knew if they discussed them after class or with their parents, but it didn't matter. The exercise had accomplished its purpose. The students were happy with themselves and with one another again. That group of students moved on. Several years later, after I had returned from a vacation, my parents met me at the airport. As we were driving home, Mother asked the usual questions about the trip, how the weather was, my experiences in general. There was a slight lull in the conversation. Mother gave Dad a sideways glance and simply said, "Dad?" My father cleared his throat. "The Eklunds called last night," he began. "Really?" I said. "I haven't heard from them for several years. I wonder how Mark is." Dad responded quietly, "Mark was killed in Vietnam." He said, "The funeral is tomorrow, and his parents would like it if you could attend." To this day, I can still point to the exact spot on I-494 where Dad told me about Mark. I had never seen a serviceman in a military coffin before wearing his uniform. Mark looked so handsome, so mature. All I could think at that moment was, "Mark, I would give all the masking tape in the world if only you could talk to me now." The church was packed with Mark's friends. Chuck's sister sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Why did it have to rain on the day of the funeral? It was difficult enough at the graveside. The pastor said the usual prayers and the bugler played taps. One by one, those who loved Mark took a last walk by the coffin. I was the last one. As I stood there, one of the soldiers who had acted as a pallbearer came up to me. "Were you Mark's math teacher?" he asked. I nodded as I continued to stare at the coffin. He said, "Mark talked about you a lot." After the funeral, most of Mark's former classmates headed to Chuck's farmhouse for lunch. Mark's mother and father were there, obviously waiting for me. "We want to show you something," his father said, taking a wallet out of his pocket. "They found this on Mark when he was killed. We thought you might recognize it." Opening the billfold, he carefully removed the two worn pieces of notebook paper that had obviously been taped, folded and refolded many times. I knew without looking that the papers were the ones on which I had listed all the good things each of Mark's classmates had said about him. "Thank you so much for doing that," Mark's mother said. As you can see, Mark treasured it. Mark's classmates started to gather around us. Chuck smiled rather sheepishly and said, "I still have my list. It's in the top drawer of my desk at home." John's wife said, "John asked me to put his in our wedding album." "I have mine too," Marilyn said. "It's in my diary." Then Vicky, another classmate, reached into her pocketbook, took out her wallet, and showed her worn and frazzled list to the group. "I carry this with me at all times." Vicky said, without batting an eyelash, "I think we have all saved our lists." That was when I finally sat down and cried and cried. I cried for Mark and for all of his friends who would never see him again. In this new year, let's build one another up. Let's stop putting them down. You may even write a note that tells them how much you think of them. They will treasure it for life. And never forget, we are not in charge. As you bow your head with me, you hardly need anything more said, but it's possible that you've just come to realize what a mess you have made of things. Because you have tried to conduct all the affairs of your life as though you're in charge. And you realize now you aren't. And the reason it's a mess is because you can't fight against God. Jesus died to give you a reason for living, to free you from the control of sin over your life, to help you do what you know is right, and you'll never be able to do it without Jesus in your life. So take him now. Don't resist. You've resisted all this time. Stop resisting. Say yes to him. Give him the controls. Invite him to come in, and he will take charge. Thank you, dear Lord, for teachers like that. Thank you for those who've helped shape our lives. Thank you for friends who love us in spite of our failures and those things we've done that needed to be forgiven. Thank you for good parents. Thank you for homes where we were loved. Thank you for this day, the first day of the rest of our lives in this new year, waiting to be lived. Take charge. We will back off and give you the controls. In Jesus' name, I pray. All God's people said, amen.